Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Price of Truth, the journalist who defied military censors to report the fall of Nazi Germany, by Richard Fine. Narrated by Paul Bamer. I've learned the hard way it is much easier to start a war than to stop one. Captain Harry C. Butcher. Fiasco is the word for it. Augusta Chronicle. Introduction. The messiest media story of World War II. A heated controversy, what the Glaswegians would call a stooshy, erupted over the military's handling of the press during the Second World War, just as that war was ending in Europe. Victory in Europe, VE Day, is celebrated each year in the United States and the United Kingdom on May 8th, commemorating the Allied victory over Germany in 1945. In Russia, Victory Day occurs on May 9th. In actuality, Germany surrendered to the Allies in the early hours of May 7th, 1945, and thereby hangs a tale. 17 journalists witnessed the event, crowded into one corner of the room chosen for the occasion at General Dwight D. Eisenhower's headquarters in Reims, France, eager to break what was surely one of the biggest stories of the war. The correspondents dashed off eyewitness accounts, only to be told that the Allied powers were withholding the news of the surrender for at least 36 hours. Authorities offered the dismayed journalists in Reims no reason for the delay. In the hours that followed, every reporter present at the surrender protested vehemently. But only one of them chose to act. The Associated Press correspondent and Paris bureau chief, Edward "Ed" Kennedy, was so certain that the public was entitled to learn of the war's end that he risked both a court-martial and his career to do so. He knew of a means to circumvent military censorship and used it to break the story of the surrender he had witnessed. The Associated Press in New York scrambled to place Kennedy's dispatch on its wire. Celebrations then broke out across the United States. New Yorkers flocked to Times Square in the thousands. In New Orleans, revelers danced in the street as if it were Mardi Gras. Crowds gathered at the gates to the White House, anticipating an official announcement. The AP itself was initially jubilant, crowing that the story was one of the greatest news beats in newspaper history. Kennedy's triumph, though, came at a high price. Angered military officials immediately suspended the reporter, citing him for a violation of military censorship and accusing him of recklessly endangering Allied soldiers in the field. 54 members of the press corps in France also denounced Kennedy for what they memorably condemned as the most deliberate, disgraceful, and unethical double-cross in the history of journalism. The reporters were so unhinged by the scoop that they passed a resolution demanding that the Army prevent the AP from any further reporting of the surrender. Perhaps the only time in the war when the press sought to muzzle itself. Kennedy earned the immediate praise of his employer and the gratitude of millions of Americans desperate for word that the fighting in Europe had ended. But the AP's president, Robert McLean, faced mounting pressure to disavow its reporter. Within days, McLean pronounced his regret over the surrender story, a public statement that was taken as the agency's repudiation of its Paris bureau chief. Kennedy never wrote another story for the Associated Press. The AP severed ties with him and refused further comment on the matter. By the end of the year, Ed Kennedy's career was in shambles. This, in a nutshell, is what some at the time referred to as the Kennedy Affair, and others, more caustically, as the surrender fiasco. No action by a U.S. correspondent during the Second World War proved more contentious, leading to what one recent historian deemed the most highly publicized and long-lasting journalistic controversy of the entire war. The debate over Ed Kennedy's actions filled editorial pages and the airwaves for weeks. Some condemned the AP's bureau chief as unethical and overzealous, arguing that he had violated journalistic ethics in not honoring his pledge to the military to hold the story until the Army released it. Others charged that he had placed his own judgment above that of the generals, particularly Eisenhower's. Still other critics claimed that Kennedy owed it to the press corps in Paris to alert them in advance that he was going to defy the news embargo. Conversely, his many defenders praised the correspondent for simply doing his job in reporting what he had witnessed, news that the U.S. public had every right to know and which officials had no sanction to suppress. They admired his courage in defying those authorities. Although some accounts of U.S. war reporting mention the surrender fiasco in passing, journalists recall it dimly, and the public has forgotten it altogether. The episode briefly resurfaced in 2012 when the Associated Press took an unprecedented step of apologizing for its treatment of Kennedy in 1945. 67 years after the event, and nearly half a century after Kennedy's death, the AP's then-president, Tom Curley, reviewed the news agency's files and determined that Kennedy had acted precisely as the AP expected its reporters to act. His superiors at the time were the ones who merited censure. Kennedy did everything just right, Curley concluded, calling the AP's dismissal of him a great, great tragedy. A group of reporters and academics agreed and mounted a sustained, if ultimately unsuccessful, campaign to have Kennedy awarded a rare posthumous Pulitzer Prize. Even then, some journalists continued to maintain that Kennedy had violated a cardinal rule of journalism in breaking an agreement with a source of information. For all the debate over whether Kennedy was a principled and courageous defender of the public's right to know, or a conniving competitor willing to sell out his colleagues and threaten soldiers' lives to achieve a scoop, critical questions about the episode remain unanswered. How did Kennedy manage to get the story to New York, given the military's supposed control of all communications from France? Had the military released the surrender news even before his story broke, as Kennedy claimed? Did the Associated Press fire Kennedy, or did he resign? Why did the Allies want to delay the release of the news of the German surrender in the first place? Such questions lingered for years. Kennedy wrote two separate but quite similar accounts of his actions. One was published in the Atlantic Monthly in 1948. The other, also written in the late 1940s, appeared, posthumously, in 2012 as a chapter in Kennedy's memoir of his days as a foreign correspondent. Their general accuracy is often corroborated by records and by the recollections of others. Kennedy professed to have had few regrets. He claimed to harbor no ill will toward those who attacked him at the time. In both accounts, he presents himself as a bemused and world-weary observer, in short, a typical reporter of his day. Kennedy's accounts provide a starting point for understanding the episode, but the path to the complete story leads thereafter to various archives in both the United States and the United Kingdom. They contain unpublished memoirs of those involved, private letters of correspondents and military officers, documents from military and press organizations, and hundreds of editorials and articles written in the aftermath of the Reims surrender. When assembled with published sources that bear on the matter, they tell a story that forces us to reconsider much of what we think we know about how the military interacted with the press during the Second World War. If Kennedy had been a novice or a known corner cutter, then his actions on May 7th could be dismissed as unprofessional or unscrupulous. The record indicates otherwise. Ed Kennedy was an experienced and respected reporter who, in 1945, supervised from Paris the AP's coverage of the war throughout northwestern Europe. After more than a decade's work domestically, Kennedy had jumped at the chance to join the AP's Paris bureau in 1935. He spent the rest of the 1930s reporting from France, from war-ravaged Spain, from Italy under Benito Mussolini, and then from the Balkans after war was declared in 1939. In 1940, Kennedy relocated to Cairo, initially to cover the British Army in Egypt, but eventually to oversee the AP's coverage of North Africa and all of the Middle East. For the remainder of the war, he served as bureau chief first in Algiers, then in Italy, and ultimately in Paris. Journalists admired Kennedy as an accomplished spot news reporter and for running effective bureaus. Although Kennedy professed to be a willing player in the hyper-competitive world of the news agencies, where filing seconds ahead of rivals often defined success, the only harsh words against him before the Reims episode were spoken by those he had beaten on a story. His superiors at the AP and most others in the press corps expressed nothing but admiration for him as an aggressive but fair-minded journalist. By 1945, then, the resumes of only a handful of war correspondents could rival his. The Kennedy affair is a compelling story on its own, but it also challenges accepted truths about the media's relationship with the military during World War II. We were all on the same side, veteran CBS journalist Andy Rooney told an interviewer late in his life, referring to his work during the war as a reporter for Stars and Stripes. It wasn't the usual confrontation between authority and the press. Historians typically agree, one venturing that the general consensus among military people, the press, and academics is that the cooperative working relationship between the press and the military that had been established in World War II collapsed in the 1960s. Some have argued that, if anything, the media was too close to the military during that conflict. Although nominally civilians, war correspondents were in several ways incorporated into the army forces, placed in uniform, granted the equivalent rank of captain, and obligated to follow most military regulations. They were totally dependent on the army for shelter, food, and transport while in the field. In Dwight Eisenhower's own famous formulation, they were quasi-staff officers. The accepted history of U.S. war reporting holds that this close and cooperative relationship between the military and the press established during the Second World War only ran off the rails in Vietnam, never to recover. Several historians, most notably Stephen Casey, have presented a more nuanced view of the assumed amity between reporters and the military during World War II, emphasizing the service rivalries, institutional pressures, and political cross-currents that impinged on that relationship. This book follows that path. The controversy over Kennedy's surrender story challenges the very premise of this prevailing amity narrative. It reveals a relationship that was frequently testy and often quite confrontational, and thus belies the reductionist portrait of that relationship as cooperative. During the course of the Second World War, Kennedy routinely, and other journalists with varying frequency, clashed with military officials over matters small and large. Although those battles were often sparked by bureaucratic bungling or army snafus, they also involved more substantive opposition to the government's handling or mishandling of information. Kennedy constantly had to hold his ground with military officials, from junior censors to actual policymakers, over the limits of military security and prerogative. Kennedy's actions in May 1945 take on greater significance when seen not as an isolated event, but rather as the culmination of career-long resistance when confronted with what he thought to be illegitimate political censorship. In this sense, the relationship of the media and the military in the Second World War, shorn of good war nostalgia, looks more, not less, like that in future conflicts than existing accounts would have us believe. Rife as the world is with widespread harassment of reporters abroad, with journalists branded as enemies of the people at home, and charges of fake news everywhere, it might help to recall an earlier era when one reporter acted on his conviction that even in wartime, the people's right to know transcended the government's desire to control information, and heartening to learn that many people supported him in doing so. The Kennedy Affair is the story of government officials trying to bend the media to their own ends, and of one journalist who risked much to do what he thought of as his duty, to inform a public sick of the fighting that the war in Europe had ended, finally. 1. Reporting the War in Europe. The Hôtel Scribe lies a short block from the opulent Palais Garnier, home of the Opéra du Paris, in one of the city's most fashionable quartiers. Built in the 1860s, the Scribe's stone façade, six-story height, and gabled mansard roof conformed to Baron Haussmann's specifications for his ambitious renovation of Paris. The Scribe claims a distinguished history. Shortly after completion, it became the home of Paris's famed jockey club. Louis Vuitton opened his first boutique in the Scribe. The Lumière brothers unveiled the cinematograph there in 1895, and Josephine Baker lived in the Scribe when she was the toast of the city after World War I. For decades, Parisian high society favored its salon. The hotel survived and even thrived in the early 1940s under German occupation, even as it remained a property of the Canadian National Railways. The German occupiers built an elaborate communications center in the Scribe, while also using it as a plush hostel for Gestapo officers. The last of the Gestapo checked out on the morning of August 25, 1944, mere hours before Allied forces arrived in the city. The Scribe had been a preferred haunt of the foreign press before the war, So enterprising public relations officers, PROs, quickly commandeered the hotel for use as Allied press headquarters before rival units could claim it as their own. The horde of correspondents who had swarmed into the city with the Allied troops soon rushed to the Scribe to join the celebrations. For the first time in my life, and probably the last, I have lived for a week in a great city where everyone is happy. The New Yorker's A.J. Liebling reported from the Scribe in early September. Since this city is Paris, he could not resist adding, everybody makes this euphoria manifest. Nowhere was this truer than at the Scribe itself, which had quickly filled with public relations officers and an ever-growing crowd of carousing war correspondents. General Omar Bradley's 12th Army Group had sent Lieutenant Colonel John Jack Redding to oversee press arrangements in Paris. When he arrived at the hotel just hours after it had been liberated, he found that everything was in an indescribable state of confusion, as war correspondents, soldiers, FFI, and tramps jammed the lobby. Redding chose to overlook the fact that everyone seemed to be carrying a heavy load of cognac or champagne. When Redding's deputy, Major James T. Quirk, arrived later that day, the bar was open and the correspondents began to hammer out their stories and get drunk simultaneously. By midnight, prostitutes had flocked to the Scribe and, according to Quirk, were doing a thriving business. With the bacchanal still in full swing the next day, Redding ordered all women out of the hotel. When an air raid klaxon sounded that night, though, Quirk found that the corridors of the upper floors quickly filled with men in pajamas and slippers and white-faced, scantily clad women huddled together for protection. For the remainder of the war, the Scribe would serve as the workplace, home, and leisure center for the press corps assigned to Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, SHAEF, General Dwight D. Eisenhower's command. For the weary PROs of that command, the unruly goings-on at the Scribe marked the end of a very trying week. The liberation of Paris had been something of a free-for-all for the press and an embarrassing debacle for Army public relations. Once it had become clear that the Allies would try to capture Paris rather than circumvent it, just about every correspondent accredited to SHAEF had to abandon their assigned beat and stampeded toward the French capital. Communications channels, spotty throughout the campaign in Normandy, all but broke down. Reporters on the road to Paris were forced to hand over stories to dispatch riders who drove them to airfields as far away as Chartres, to be flown back to First Army headquarters, weather permitting, for onward transmission to London. Many dispatches were lost along the way. Most were delayed by hours, if not days. One story that did get through proved most embarrassing to CBS's Charles Collingwood and to censorship officials. On August 21st, and 4 days before the actual liberation, Collingwood had written a story anticipating the event. Collingwood recorded his script, "Parisians had risen as one man to beat down the German troops," and sent the recording and script to London. CBS then put Collingwood's story on the air 2 days before the Germans actually surrendered the city. Collingwood later claimed that he had been assured the story would not be released in London until Paris was indeed liberated. CBS and censors in London assumed it had been vetted in France. Based on Collingwood's report, England's King George IV had also announced that Paris was now free, forcing SHAEF officials into the embarrassing position of having to contradict the monarch. At roughly the same time, the Allied advance paused at Rambouillet, some 30 miles southwest of Paris, where reporters and public relations officers alike were surprised to discover that Ernest Hemingway, on assignment from Collier's, was already there. Hemingway had taken it upon himself to play soldier and was commanding a scruffy band of French teenagers. Armed to the teeth, in violation of the Geneva Convention, Hemingway strutted through Rambouillet, claiming that he and his irregulars had been spying on the German forces, preparing to attack the town. Since there was no conceivable reason for any Germans to try to take Rambouillet, remarked NBC's John McVane, one of the reporters on the scene, this sort of talk made something less than a sensation among Hemingway's rather cynical audience. Hemingway's posturing proved too much for the Chicago Times's Bruce Grant, who told the middle-aged writer to stop trying to be a chicken-shit general with your chicken-shit little army. This had earned Grant a punch in the face. Army officials had little tolerance for Hemingway's shenanigans and ordered a full-scale investigation of his conduct. What is more, when French and U.S. troops finally reached the city on August 25th, 6 radio correspondents broadcast stories using the Radio France transmitter there without first submitting their scripts for censorship. Schaaf immediately suspended the 6, charging that they had not gone to the Scribe for the required vetting of their copy. Their actions had angered those correspondents who had abided by Schaaf rules. McVane had maneuvered to be first in line to have his copy cleared by the censors at the Scribe, and so was particularly peeved at being robbed of his scoop. Schaaf's Public Relations Division, PRD, had recommended a 60-day suspension of the broadcasters, which Eisenhower reduced to 40. That street fighting in Paris still continued on the day in question, and that the broadcasts had contained no sensitive military information, dissuaded authorities from imposing a stiffer penalty. For one PRD official, the culprits had betrayed the other correspondents who had braved sniper fire to get to the censors at the Scribe, as well as thrown the gauntlet down for Schaaf. Would we or would we not enforce regulations? Don Whitehead, the Associated Press, AP, correspondent on the scene, cabled his office in New York, I wish to enter strongest possible protest against unauthorized broadcast, which in violation of censorship regulations, to which others adhered. We signed agreement that we would not transmit copy any source without censorship, with severe penalties to be inflicted on those who tried evasion. Our Paris stories passed through normal security channels, and we played by rules which Army set up. If we cannot be assured of their enforcement, then Army's regulations only burden those who think they are duty-bound to stick to rules. I never want to penalize initial resourcefulness, but I do want to know all of us are playing by same rules in same league. The next month, Whitehead's boss, Kent Cooper, the managing director of the AP, wrote to the cooperative's members that he was certain this incident will act as a deterrent to any other correspondent who is tempted to do the same thing. There isn't a newspaper man in this country who wants to see a war correspondent gain a temporary advantage by violating his pledge to the detriment of his fellow correspondents. Whitehead and Cooper's words would come back to haunt the Associated Press 8 months later, when the Scribe would again be the scene of great pandemonium. Only this time, more choleric than bacchanalian. On May 6, 1945, the PRD quietly assembled a select group of war correspondents, soon to be dubbed the Lucky 17, in the lobby of the Scribe to report on an unspecified event of historical importance. The scribe had been on edge for
Sample complete. Ready to continue?